So let's use this half an hour before lunch just to explore together what's been going on for us this morning. In other words, to share and to perhaps ask questions about the practicalities, the experience of the kind of meditation we've been doing. Maybe some of the language that I used this morning to frame it, the idea of inner autonomy, of honesty. But anything else that somehow comes out of this experience, it need not be a question, it could simply be a reflection. Und natürlich, wenn Sie Ihre Fragen oder Bemerkungen auf Deutsch stellen wollen, wollen, dann könnten Sie auf Deutsch sprechen. If I need a translation, I will ask someone. So who would like to start? Okay. As we hope. Did everyone hear that? Yeah? I've thought a lot about this, actually, over the years. The difference for me is between thinking of meditation as a technique and thinking of meditation more as the refinement of a sensibility, of a perspective on life, an outlook. I'm aware, though, that it's often meditation, mindfulness in particular, is often presented as a technique. And it's important, I think, to bear in mind what the word technique carries within it. It's a very loaded word. In German, the connection between technique and technology is much more obvious. You say das der Technik or das Technik. now you realize how painful it is to learn German as a non-native speaker. I think when we think of meditation as a technique, we bring to it many of our kind of cultural assumptions about technology. Technology is basically a system of solving problems. In other words, if you can identify the problem, then you can identify what a solution to the problem would be, and then you can introduce a series of interventions or exercises or steps that when completed will solve the problem, and the problem will then have disappeared. You'll have solved the problem. And if your car breaks down, you call a mechanic. The mechanic says, oh, the problem's here. Well, we have to do this. Then we'll solve the problem. It's done, and the car goes fine. Now, I think all of that is held implicitly as soon as we say meditation is a technique. But also, when we frame meditation within the Four Noble Truths, we get a very similar technological picture. We get suffering, it's a problem. The cause of the problem is craving or ignorance. We get rid of craving or ignorance, the problem goes away. It's actually a very technological way of thinking. And that could be why it's so intuitively attractive. But as you say, I don't think in the deeper sense meditation is a technique. Of course, if we use mindfulness in a medical intervention, then it is certainly being used as a technique, and it is often very successful. But when we seek to apply meditation not to something, let's say, like panic attacks or depression, but if we take meditation as a way of coming to terms with life, and this is where your point, Katerina, comes, that being human is not a problem that can be solved. Birth, sickness, aging, and death are not problems that can be solved, although Buddhism actually does treat them that way. Traditional Buddhism will say, if you gain insight into the nature of reality or nirvana or whatever, and you you sort of purify the mind of all of these negative things, then the problem of suffering will disappear. There will be no more suffering. The end of suffering, this famous Buddhist ideal. But frankly, birth, sickness, aging, and death are not problems to be solved. Rather, they are mysteries to be penetrated, mysteries to be embraced. And the you see, the difference is a technique also implies a distance between the problem and the person who has the problem. So if I've got a problem with my car, I can look at the car objectively, sort out the problem, and fix it. But the difference with being human is that I cannot separate myself from the problem of being me. I cannot separate myself from birth, sickness, aging, and death. These are not things that I stand apart from. They are part and parcel of who we are. So the whole question of using techniques to solve problems is arguably not appropriate here. But instead, it's a question of embracing the situation we're in. If we substitute the four truths for the four tasks, then I think it all becomes a lot clearer. The point is actually to embrace the dukkha, the suffering, life, basically, at the same time to embrace our reactive responses to life, liking, not liking, fear, hatred, all that stuff. We embrace that too. And in doing so, we let those reactive patterns somehow come to rest. And in coming to rest, that opens up a non-reactive space from which we can then respond in a way that's appropriate to the condition we find ourselves in at that time. And that's not a technical process. That's a process that, if anything, calls more for imagination than technical expertise. It calls for creativity. What is the wise response to this situation? For me, the ethics of the Dharma is situational. In other words, it's recognizing that each situation is unique and that response to it can certainly be guided by a broad sort of commitment not to cause harm, not to kill, steal, and so on. But that's really just the framework. The actual ethical response is something that requires an imaginative way of being with the situation totally and responding in a way that hopefully will make a difference. But secular Dharma is also an ethic of risk. In other words, we cannot know the outcome in advance. We cannot see the future. We can do something with the very best of intentions and make things worse. In other words, there's always an element of risk in a situational ethic. But I'm running ahead of myself. But does that get your point or not? That's right, yeah. Mm. Okay, well, we'll probably come back. I will probably come back to some of that this afternoon. Yes. Yeah. Well, you see, we create this thing called the secular Buddhist church, and that won't have these problems. we'll actually write that into the definition. this will not become an institution. No, what you point to, I think, is a feature of human behavior that endlessly repeats over historical time. My favorite example of this is St. Francis, who founded the Franciscan order when he was how old he was, probably middle-aged. But before he died, he left it in disgust. He wandered off. There's even an occasion in the suttas, the Buddhist discourses, where the Buddha did something similar. It's called the Quarrel at Kosambi. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's a story about a bunch of monks in this rather remote monastery in the city of Kosambi. Kosambi's way to the west of where the Buddha usually taught. It's as far west as he ever goes. It's beyond Allahabad today. And this is a typical kind of religious institution problem. The monks got in an argument, believe it or not, about how to use the jug, the container that you wipe your ass with after going to the toilet. And there was all kinds of disputes about this, and it got to such a pitch that the monks got divided into two factions. Their respective lay followers got split into different factions, and the whole thing blew up into this crazy kind of thing. But fortunately, the Buddha showed up. But the Buddha couldn't solve the problem either. And he got so frustrated with it, it says in the text, after having taken his morning meal, he wrapped up his robe and his bowl, and without telling anybody, left the monastery and went off into a forest. And as he was sitting in the forest, a bull elephant came and sat next to him. And the bull this is fairy tale, but the bull elephant sat next to him and said, "You know, it's so bloody hard being around with all these female elephants and children elephants and other elephants, and I just can't take it anymore, so I've come to this forest and I'm sitting here to chill, basically." And then the Buddha says, "You know, that's absolutely right. There's no end of trouble with these monks and these nuns and these laymen and these..." Now, I like that story. I think it says something precisely about what you're pointing to, that with the best of intentions, great figures from both religion, philosophy, politics, they create these institutions, and they all tend to follow the same kind of pattern. You once again end up with dogmas and hierarchies and power structures and inclusion, exclusion, who's in, who's out, what's acceptable, what's unacceptable. And you find yourself back in the situation you tried to free yourself from. So this, I think, points to a feature of human behavior that seems very, very deeply embedded. And the question I've asked myself for many years is there another way of doing this? Can we find a way of being a community without all of these constraints? And I'm not actually sure what the answer is. I do feel very strongly that community is crucially important. But I'm also very wary of what happens when human beings try to create communities. It's and interestingly, next year we're going to look at community as our main focus next November here in Heidelberg. So we can come back to that then perhaps. But this to me is one of the really big questions. How do we do this? And again, I remember once when I lived in Dharamsala back in the 70s, if you had been there for a while, before you left, you could have a private interview with the Dalai Lama. And so a lot of my friends would go and have this interview with the Dalai Lama. And he always said the same thing. He says, "When you go back to the West, don't live in a Buddhist center." Because usually that was the plan. You know, "I'm going to go back to the West, Your Holiness. I'm going to create this center and spread the Dharma." He said, "Don't live in a Buddhist center." He says, "Become part of your society. Just live an ordinary life and manifest and share and express the Dharma through your ordinary life." And I think that was a very wise thing to say. And I found it very moving that this was his approach. But again, that may not be a solution either. Because again, there's no sense there of being part of a community, really. You're sort of, I don't know if you've read The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham. Do you know that novel? At the end of that novel, this young man who's been out studying with a guru in India goes back to New York and then becomes a taxi driver and disappears into the New York taxi world. I'm not sure that's a solution. It's too romantic. The real challenge is to actually find way, to ask how we can reimagine community in a way that at least minimizes the problems it often tends to produce. There's a question there? Yes.
I
Well, first thing I want to tell you is that it has nothing to do with being German. yeah, it may have a pleased role, but frankly, if you could be magically transformed into an Italian, I think you would have the same problem. I think it's a fundamental human problem, this. And I think what, again, reminds me a bit of what Sylvia was saying yesterday. The point is not to become perfect at these exercises. It's not to become the world's most proficient meditator. The purpose is to become more conscious of how we behave. It's a training, it's an exercise in becoming more aware of our foibles, our weaknesses, our strengths, and having the humility to recognize that I'll probably always be subject to these reactive patterns. I try my best to live with them better, to respond more appropriately to them. But I'm aware that after, in my case, 40 years or plus of meditation, I still find myself having a bad sitting, or I can't get rid of a particular thought, or whatever. So I think there is a need to have the humility to accept our humanity. And our humanity is grounded in our existence as a biologically evolved animal. That's the kind of creature we are that has been remarkably successful over thousands and millions of years of surviving, of carving out its ecological niche. And what we are encountering in meditation, particularly, you know, once we get beyond the surface chatter, is we encounter, I think, the legacy of our evolution. And greed and hatred are clearly fundamental structures of any kind of sentient life. You go back to the primeval swamp and you've got your protozoa swimming around in a pool, and basically they are reaction machines, attracted to food or mates and repelled by threats or enemies. It's the same thing. Want, not want, like, dislike. But these are creatures without brains or nervous systems, but nonetheless that is the primary kind of dynamic of any kind of autonomous organism. So it's hardly surprising that these things don't disappear overnight or after having done a few meditation retreats. It's also, I think, suggested very strongly in the suttas, in the discourses, in the encounters between Buddha and Mara. The Buddha and Mara is the sort of the demonic devil figure, who's obviously just a personification of reactivity. But what's interesting is that after the Buddha has overcome Mara, and this is usually understood as an aspect of his awakening, that he conquers the armies of Mara, that doesn't mean that Mara stops appearing to him. In fact, most of the dialogues between Buddha and Mara, but I would say nearly all of them, occur after the awakening, right up until shortly before his death. And so the idea that conquering Mara or conquering reactivity means these things basically just disappear doesn't seem to be the case, even with the Buddha. The Buddha's still encountering Mara. Now, I don't believe that Mara is some god or spirit who comes down to earth and has a conversation with the Buddha, then disappears. Mara is a way of talking about the Buddha's own conflicted humanity. That's all. So that I found very helpful. It dispels the idea that somehow I have to become perfect at doing these practices. Unfortunately, Buddhism doesn't help sometimes because it uses expressions like greed and hatred and delusion should be are cut off like a palm stump, never to arise again, is what it says. So you get that idea too. And that's also in the text. So you've got a problem here. The idea that you can somehow delete reactivity for good, on the one hand, and the idea that reactivity will constantly be happening to you as long as you are in this body, effectively. So the practice, therefore, has to, I think, be adjusted. Or let's say your expectations of the practice have to be adjusted to fit the reality of your biology, basically. So it's about, again, acceptance rather than the idea of getting rid of something for good, and realizing that these challenges will probably be with us until we die, that this is a lifelong practice. Hopefully we'll get better at it. I think that's certainly true. We get more skilled, and the less we get lost or caught up in our reactive patterns, the more we somehow remove the fuel that keeps them charged up. So yeah, I think they do diminish. I think we do calm down over time. We get more and more stillness. And we learn also to come to dwell in a mindful, non-reactive space, even when reactivity is going on. That's the key to me. And that, I think, is, you know, hand on heart, what this practice has really brought in my own life, is this increasing capacity to dwell in a kind of inner stillness, even in the midst of all kinds of trouble and chaos. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. No, I think that is a language we find. It's quite common to find that when you hear of people talking of, say, Advaita Vedanta. The problem for me there is a philosophical one, because the witness becomes reified into something that is, you know, sort of permanently removed from the complexity of life. It reinforces a sense of a kind of a disassociated ego of some kind. So I'm reluctant to use the word, I don't in my, when I speak, use the word witness. But recently I've been actually becoming much more sympathetic to that language, provided it doesn't carry the ontological commitments. I think it is a useful metaphor to be able to simply be a witness of what is going on rather than a victim. That, I think, is certainly a more useful way to deal with one's experience. And I think practically, in the practice of mindfulness, you do adopt the stance of someone who is witnessing experience rather than either interfering or feeling overwhelmed by it. So that's useful. And many of the metaphors for mindfulness suggest this, like the watchman at the gate of the city has to witness what's going on, has to be very attentive to what's going on and not get caught up in their own stories and fantasies, or to feel constantly fearful or in danger. So yeah, if we think of it that way, I think it's very helpful. Okay, one last question, then we'll go. Yeah. You were wondering about that. Well, I think now that you've asked that question, I might actually address that tomorrow in my talk. I mean, I've just spent a number of years writing a book on this topic, and with the time we don't have now, I'd rather leave that one, but I haven't forgotten about it. I'll come back to it.